Welcome to the Math Ed Podcast. My name is Sam Otten from the University of Missouri, and my guest today is Dr. Melissa Gallagher, who's a faculty member in curriculum and instruction at the University of Houston. Melissa, it's great to talk to you.
Hey, Sam. Great to talk to you, too.
We are going to be talking about a few things that Melissa's working on. We, of course, will get into a little bit of conversation about some research on adaptive teaching. But I also brought Melissa in because I've been noticing that she's been doing some math ed things on social media, and I think it's really exciting and cool. So I'm also going to just chat with her about some of the things she's trying out for ways of integrating some math ed ideas and getting them out there into the world in some new ways, which I'm a fan of. So we'll be hitting a few different things, and I really look forward to it. But I do want to start on the research side, Melissa. So I thought maybe we could chat a little bit about a particular article that you wrote that brought together some research around adaptive teaching. So this article you wrote with Seth Parsons and Margaret Vaughn, and it was published in the journal Educational Review in volume 74, and it's entitled Adaptive Teaching in Mathematics, a Review of the Literature. So a nice, solid title, getting into a lit review on adaptive teaching. So first of all, just let us know, what is adaptive teaching? And then what was it that led you to doing this analysis and this reading and in-depth thinking about adaptive teaching?
So adaptive teaching is, many people would just classify it as good teaching. It's the idea that you don't just follow a script, but that you thoughtfully make modifications, whether it's to your instruction plan, your lesson plan that you wrote, or to a lesson plan in a textbook or curriculum materials. But you thoughtfully make modifications to that, both during your planning period, when you're kind of looking at it and considering your students, considering data that you have on your students, as well as including assessment data, but also, you know, just what you know about them as people. And then that you make also adaptations or modifications in the moment while you're teaching. So this, many of us in math ed study it, right? The way that teachers will pivot or turn or take up a student's idea. And so, and I really like adaptive teaching as a construct, because that in the moment while you're teaching definition of adaptive teaching, I think, really fits with what we call teacher noticing in math ed. But adaptive teaching as a construct then also includes that outside of the moment, right, during your planning period and things, looking at and making thoughtful decisions, which some folks in teacher noticing take up as well. So I was involved with this research group starting when I was a doctoral student, and we published a literature review on adaptive teaching across the content areas in Review of Educational Research in 2018. But I had joined the team late as their math ed person, and there were already several rounds into data analysis, and I was like, but what about teacher noticing? Y'all left that out, which obviously is a big left out than a lot of math ed work related to adaptive teaching. And so what this lit review is, we took the math ed pieces that were in the 2018 article, but then we also did a literature review that added teacher noticing through those years, and added that together. And it came up with some interesting findings. So there's a figure in the discussion of that paper that takes the model of adaptive teaching that we came up with in the 2018 piece for across the content areas, but in it, we include in italics the pieces that are unique to math ed that we found. For instance, that teachers use curricular materials as one of their points of reference when thinking about making decisions, that teachers use learning trajectories. That didn't really come out across that content area, but when we look specifically at math, it makes sense that we're talking about using learning trajectories to interpret what students need next. And then classroom discourse did not come up in the whole across the contents, but was very specific to math ed. And selecting teaching aids or tools, which again makes sense. We're thinking about what manipulatives you might want to use next. So I think it made some interesting contributions beyond that first piece.
Yeah. I'm interested in this topic just as an educational point of conversation. I wonder amongst the team, I know there's not a specific answer to this, but I just wonder if it was something you talked about with your team. Did you try to estimate how much of teaching is planned and how much of teaching is adapting and stuff that was not planned and some stuff you had to respond to? I know there's not exact numbers, but to me, it's sort of a fun thing to think about. And maybe people have different styles about. Some person's like, oh, I'm an 80% plan person and only 20% adaptation. Somebody else is like, oh, I'm 50-50. I don't know if that was ever part of the conversations or if you have thoughts about that.
Yeah. So they actually have been working on an adaptive teaching observation protocol for use in literacy classrooms, where they compare the lesson plan to what happens in the classroom. Some limitations with doing that work, though, is that some teachers' lesson plans is three bullet points in their planner. Mm-hmm. So basically everything is an adaptation because you're just kind of fine by the seat of your pants. And then in other classrooms, there's a lot more mandated adhering to scripted curricula type things happening. So there was some lack of flexibility. There's quite a wide range of the way that adaptation gets implemented.
So the context and the system can put some parameters around how much is adaptive, how much is planned ahead of time, but then also the teacher's style might come in there and move the percentages a little bit more. For me, it's just kind of fun to think about as a way to even conceive of teaching is like how much is adaptation or adaptive teaching.
Yeah. On that note, I think I'm one of the few university professors I know who still writes out like pages and pages of lesson plans for every lesson that I teach. Mm-hmm. I know some folks do it, but I'm told it's rare.
For me, I often use the slides and maybe slide notes. And I, you know, so I kind of have a plan of what I think will happen on this slide or what I think will happen after this slide. And so I don't write all of that out, but I sort of have an expectation in mind of what I think is going to happen. And then sometimes totally different things come into play and like, oh, I'm definitely going to respond to that. Or we're going to change gears and go this way because it seems important. So it definitely seems to get at some of the heart of teaching and like the actual dynamic process of teaching.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, sounds like you're a very adaptive teacher.
So you were alluding to some of the math ed specific things that you were able to bring into this article, which we love to hear here on the Math Ed podcast. But I wonder if you could just say a little bit more about some main ideas or some main findings that did come out from the math specific lit review.
We found that adaptive teaching generally across all the content areas follows the same kind of structure, which is there's some piece of information that the teacher uses that they interpret and then decide how to respond. So very much aligned with, for instance, Jacobs, Lamb, and Phillips' professional noticing framework, which is why leaving teacher noticing out was such a misstep in the original article. But that within math ed, there's much more looking at the curriculum and the materials as they come to you. And I think part of the reason for that is that the numbers we choose to use are so important in a math classroom. I think in a literacy classroom, the text that you choose to use is important, but there are probably a whole bunch of texts that might help you teach the same reading strategy. But in math, if I want students to use a strategy of comparing fractions to the benchmark of 1/2, then I need to pick fractions that are just above and just below the benchmark of 1/2 that they can reason about, right? So the numbers I choose are really important. And so you really see that emphasis kind of coming out in the studies that we reviewed, that really thinking about those numbers and those numbers in relation to the learning trajectories and what your students need next was really important. There's also a real need to focus on who students are, their cultural and linguistic practices, their backgrounds, and then consider all that within the complexity of the classroom setting. So there's a lot kind of at play here. Another thing we talk about a lot in math ed that definitely came up in the math ed specific construction of or model of adaptive teaching is the orchestrating classroom discussion and how purposeful a lot of our research is around how to do that. You know, thinking about Keith Latham and Sherry Staccaro and Laura Van Zost and all their work around MOSTs and picking up on those mathematical moments and knowing which ones to attune to. Or if we think about Jonathan Thomas, Molly Fisher, and Edna Schack and Cindy John's work around professional noticing, where they're looking at the responsiveness of teachers to those specific moments, knowing which mathematical moments to pick up on as you make those adaptive decisions was something that definitely came up differently in the math ed research.
Yeah, and you mentioned the students themselves, their cultural linguistic backgrounds and strengths and experiences. I know in other parts of your research, you really focus a lot on multilingual learners and how we can think about those as math educators. Do you want to say a little bit more about adaptive teaching, but maybe with multilingual learners as your students and what does that require of teachers' adaptability?
Yeah, so our lit review spanned a wide range of time. And so in the earlier years, you see kind of this discussion of math as a universal language and, you know, multilingual learners can just do it because it's math, so we don't have to worry about the language. And then a lot more recently, you know, we see Catherine Chabal and Sandra DiRaggio and lots of great folks in math ed talking about the linguistic resources, the language resources that students bring to the classroom. Judith Moshkevich, of course, is big in this, and how teachers can respond to those language resources and those assets to build on students' mathematical understandings. You know, we see Martha Seville's work and thinking about building on families' work, families and community knowledge and leveraging that to support multilingual learners in the math classroom. So all of that within the adaptive teaching framework, all of that goes into teachers' knowledge of their students. It all filters into that decision making. And so that's why those kind of deep knowledge of your students and relationships with them is so key, because when you're responding, you're not just responding to an answer, you're responding to a child. So thinking about that in the work that we do as teachers.
I know there's a lot of effort that can happen in planning where you are trying to think about how am I going to draw on the linguistic resources? How am I going to make connections to the students' backgrounds? But to me, it seems important to realize that is important and then also be prepared to adapt to the student in the moment. And especially with multilingual learners, the dynamics that might be happening with the language in the room, you won't be able to predict all of those in advance.
Yes, exactly. And there's some cool work going on right now, like Julia Aguirre and her team are doing some really cool work on culturally sustaining mathematical modeling tasks. So you can plan it, but then you also have to, as you said, be willing to and ready to pivot in the moment. And there, of course, is plenty of research that we still need to support teachers in learning how to recognize those moments from an asset-based perspective. But just because a student isn't giving you the correct answer doesn't mean that they can't. We may need to support their language in a different way. And all of that kind of filters into adaptive teaching. So adaptive teaching is a really big construct, and yet we can think about it in these discrete pieces.
Mm-hmm. I'm curious what you see as the next steps, either like yourself, it seems like it's something you've been working on for years. Are there next steps for you or next steps that you think the field needs to take on related to adaptive teaching?
So one thing in my work with pre-service teachers and in just discussing with other math educators is that it can be really hard to know how to interpret and make the next step and decide on the next step in the best, most equitable way. When you interpret a student's thinking, there are different possible interpretations. And then when you decide on the next step, I mean, there are almost an infinite number of next steps you could take. So how do we support pre-service teachers in building these practices? How do we even, like, is there a right way? What is the best way? What is the best next decision to make? And so I've been working with a team to develop, we have a DRK 12 grant under review right now. So if any of your listeners are reviewing, you know, 4 stars, 5 stars for us. What the focus of that is using learning trajectories to help teachers interpret students' thinking according to the learning trajectories in a way that you're looking for what conceptions they hold instead of what so often happens where we're looking for what students get wrong. So really trying to zoom in, because it is pretty big, in on that interpreting part.
Yeah. Well, it's great to talk to you about it. We could talk a lot more about it because I do think it is a fascinating topic and it brings together a lot of different ideas, as you mentioned. But I'll just point the listeners to the journal Educational Review, and they can find your article there. But also, they can find some of your activity on Facebook and social media. And I wonder if you could actually just tell us a little bit about one of your new efforts that you've been making on social media that I observed and is part of why I wanted to talk to you.
Yeah, well, I appreciate you reaching out. This is absolutely a labor of love. I became a mother about 1.5 years ago. And once I did that, I changed who I was following on social media. Now I follow speech and language pathologists and early childhood development specialists, occupational therapists, literacy specialists. And I realized that I wasn't following any early childhood math folks. So I started looking for them. And I looked and I looked and I looked and I couldn't find anyone. So I started asking my mom friends if they were following anyone, and nobody seemed to be. And I reached out in my academic moms group and none of them were following anyone. So I was like, well, that seems like a gaping black hole of need. And so I decided, well, if it doesn't exist, then what I'm doing is essentially, you know, reading Clements and Sarama and reading the early childhood research myself and making those decisions about what to do with my child. But it's not that far of a stretch for me then to post about it so that other people can try it. And so that's what I've been doing. But then there's this whole black hole, maybe you've encountered it because you do operate in social media spaces as well, of like people trying to sell you courses on how to.
I was going to say, that's what is there, is a lot of ads and stuff. And oh, this great product will make your kid an Einstein. It's like, okay, you're not striking the right tone here.
Yeah, there's a lot of that. And there's a fair bit for teachers, not all of it necessarily grounded in, I think, what mathematics education researchers would agree is best practice. A lot of tricks. But since I started the account, some of my followers send me videos of other people showing tricks, and they ask me, like, why is this working? So I've actually made a lot of individual videos of, like, here's why this trick works. And these
Yeah,
are the
yeah.
circumstances under which it will work. So you can't just broadly apply this. So.
Yeah, the trick can become a site for some good thinking or conversations with kids or something like that. I think kids are, at least in my experience, they usually want to know what's behind the trick and why it's working. So that can become good. But like just having the trick and stopping there is not necessarily what we're after. So you're posting some things. They're kind of aimed at parents. They're sort of aimed at like the general public, but it's coming from somebody that, you know, has some insight into math education. Could you give a couple examples of things that you've posted so far?
Sure. So one thing that occurred to me, a lot of what I do is just pay attention to what I'm doing with my own daughter or questions that I have about her mathematics learning, because early childhood math ed is not my expertise. I'm elementary into upper elementary, middle. And so paying attention to what I'm doing with her and then wondering about where's the math in that, or how could I connect it to math, or how does that connect to the research in math ed, and then going and looking it up. And so I realized that a lot of what I was doing relate to the mathematical practices. My husband is also a math educator, former high school math teacher. So we always just in our home life talk about math, right? I tell him things like, don't tell me you'll be ready in 3 minutes. You can't attend with that level of precision to this activity, right? And so that's the discourse in our house. And so thinking about those mathematical practices and realizing that I know they're not well taken up in most classrooms. And certainly I don't think that like the everyday person is talking to their toddler about attending to precision. And so I started thinking about how could I share those, because those are absolutely practices that you can start to develop with your kids when they're little. And if those just become the norm in your household, maybe those things will be easier as they grow up.
I think like repeated reasoning and just kind of noticing and calling out patterns in that repeated reasoning is something that is another practice that I feel like, oh, you could do that with kids. You could sort of help them to just step out and realize, oh, there's a pattern here that's happening.
Yeah, absolutely. And actually the math practice that got me started on it was I was realizing that my husband and I were both always encouraging our daughter to persevere in problem solving. It's like, hey, isn't that SMP1? And so that kind of launched that series that I've been doing on the mathematical practices. Also, sometimes just like frustration with things I see. Like I was looking at board books recently, and there was a beautiful Eric Carle illustrated geometry book with a diamond in it. I got so mad. So I did a post on like geometry misterms kind of thing. So
yeah, that's great. Yeah. And listeners might remember too, Julie Nurnberger Haig, who's been on here talking about her shapebook study, because she just got frustrated with things that were called triangles. Like, that's not a triangle. Like, it has clearly curved, you know, doesn't have vertices, and it's not straight edges and various things. So she started to also be like, let's try to do better with kids' books about shapes, and especially when they're explicitly supposed to be teaching shapes.
Yeah.
Then it would seem like a time to try to get it right. Or we can equip people, parents, to have the conversation. So even if the book is not accurate, that's okay if you talk to the kid about the accuracy and make it kind of a fun little critiquing of the book and not just accepting it as like the truth or something.
One of my friends actually went through all of her daughter's, after listening to me rant, went through all of her daughter's picture books, geometry picture books, with a straight edge and a marker to make sure that all of the lines were straight, all of the edges were straight, and vertices were actual vertices and points. So yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Another one that I did when I started having kids was just to count past 10. So like stopping at different numbers. So sometimes stop at 9, but also sometimes stop at 12 or 13, because TV, YouTube, books, everything is going to go to 10 and then stop as if like you've reached the end of the numbers or whatever. So that helped. And I feel like it did really go over well with my kids. Like, oh yeah, you can go to 13, 15, go to 17, like, and just go to different places at different times and sort of just show like numbers go where you need them to go. It's not like just 10 is the end of everything.
And starting at zero too. I mean,
yes.
When it makes sense, you know, to include zero as a number. So many, a common misconception among kindergartners is that zero is not a number. And so kind of including that in the count. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So Who are you hoping to reach? Like, what and what would you love to see from like these social media efforts? What would be a sign of success or that it's been worth your time?
I think being invited to talk about it here feels like a sign of success. I have to tell you, I it's exhausting, you know, working all day, momming in the evening, and then 9 o'clock at night, I'm like, oh, am I going to make a post now? How am I going to work this out? So, you know, for it to be taken up in different spaces, for people to comment that they're being more aware of their numbers with their kids. I'm not gaining followers all that quickly. I don't know, maybe I need to buy one of those get followers quick packages. But, you know, I think the reason is because people don't worry about their kid being behind in math really until they get to be second or third grade, I feel like. Whereas like if they're delayed in speech, parents are worried about it from 13, 14 months. If they're delayed right. physically, you're worried about it right away, which I'm not knocking that. That absolutely right, right. makes sense. But we need to support our kids in their mathematical development just as much as we support them in their language and literacy.
Right. So where should people look for you? I think we can get those follower numbers up a little bit.
Yeah, that would be great. At Math with Melissa on Instagram and Math with Melissa on Facebook and Math with Melissa on YouTube.
Perfect.
Mathwithmelissa.org.
Sounds good. Well, I just want to finish with my kind of standard questions, but I do want to get a little bit of background for folks. Where did you do your grad studies and who was your advisor at that time?
I did my graduate studies at George Mason University in Virginia, and my advisor was Gary Galuzzo. He's a teacher educator. But my academic math mama is Jennifer Suh.
Oh, yeah. And then just briefly, what was the focus of your dissertation? I know that could be a whole nother podcast episode, but...
I looked at profiles of teachers' practice and how those profiles predicted student achievement.
And what grade level?
Grades 4 and 5.
Okay. Yeah. So still that upper elementary kind of zone. Yeah. All right. And then if you were not in math education, is there another career you could imagine for yourself? It could be realistic or it could just be a fantastical imagining.
Yeah. So such an interesting question, Sam. I thought about this one a lot. I rode horses when I was little. We lived in El Salvador. And so that kind of thing was easier to do there. And then continued through high school, even picked my college because I could still ride. And then had to stop because I was a teacher and had to pay for it myself as an adult. And that wasn't going to work anymore. But one of the things I did an IB diploma in high school and I studied. So I had to do a thesis and I studied using horseback riding as therapy for people with different physical disabilities or limitations. And so I think I might have looked into occupational therapy using horseback riding.
Oh, wow.
Very different. But...
might be the most unique answer that I've heard so far. And I've done 190 something of these. But I wasn't sure where you were going to go with the horse. Like, okay, how would this become a career? And oh, wow, occupational therapy with the horses is interesting.
Yeah, it was just so interesting to hear about how they were being used to help people connect and reconnect with their bodies after different ailments.
Right. Cause you hear about things that like, you know, emotional support through animals and connections, relationship with animals. So you can kind of have that, but then you also have the physical part of actually doing the riding. And so now you're getting physical stuff too. So I can see the blend of both of those. Wow. All right. Interesting. Well, thanks for going on this conversational journey with me. I'm happy that we could touch on a few different topics and it was really fun talking to you.
Yeah. I appreciate it so much. Thank you, Sam. Thank you.